Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from, actually, we're starting on time today, 12. Yeah, to about 12:45. Actually, next week might be a problem. Going to Germany next week. Last time I was in Germany, we did Cooking Issues live from a street corner in Germany. You want to see whether we can do the live German Cooking Issues again?
Yeah, more off the wall than a street corner.
Well, I mean, like, look, honestly, if I'm going to do it, I probably have to do it in the hotel with Skype. Otherwise, I mean, like, we were just lucky that my phone didn't get cut out or I didn't get beat over the head by some sort of angry, ex-East German last time I did it. But we love the angry ex-East Germans, by the way. It's no offense. Calling all of your cooking questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So, Stas, last week on the show, we had our friend Ariel from UC Davis and Brooks Headley, the pastry chef that more people need to know about from Del Posto Restaurant. He got a call or a question in asking about the 7-course vegan tasting menu that they do at Del Posto. Nastasha made her vegan face, which, by the way, now I can relate to you all. She would not let me take a picture of it. Literally, like, I pulled up the camera maybe 8-10 times. I caught her once as she was exiting the vegan face, but I couldn't get the full vegan face on camera because she refused to let me get it. But if you've ever seen either The Sopranos or Steven Van Zandt on his new show, Lillehammer, his angry gangster face scowl, like the kind of bulldog frown, that's pretty much the vegan face right there.
So you can just—it's pretty popular. I see even on iTunes, one of the reviews was referencing the vegan face.
Man, really,
it's blowing up.
Really,
well,
and
you know,
I suspect maybe Nastasha can't even make the real vegan face anymore.
No, I can.
Well, right. It's when she doesn't mean to do it. That's when she
right.
did it. So
just
like,
happens.
You could see her true reaction to the vegan lunch. It's like I don't need to actually ask her. I just look over and see. You know, is Steven Van Zandt sitting next to me, or is Nastasha sitting next to me?
Wow.
And you know, that's basically how you do it. So, by the way, I'm about to get in big trouble with our good friends over at Del Posto, Mark Ladner and Brooks, because here's what they said. They actually enjoy making the they said, first of all, don't publicize the vegan thing. Thank God, our cadre of listeners is loyal, but you know, we're not there. You know. Well, whatever. We don't have enough visitors to blow up Del Posto, right?
Right,
right or wrong. So,
right.
So I'm not going to get in trouble.
See.
Well, we'll see. You'll find out. So here's what they said. Any good cook likes a challenge and likes a set of constraints in which they can work and try to get new ideas to try and push their skills, push their talents, right? And this could be anything. Like, so when we did the museum event last year, also at Del Posto, you know, we pushed the bartenders and the cooks into areas they wouldn't normally work by giving them a set of constraints. You're going to work with, you know, this set of ingredients or this time, you know, this time, or like, you know, Nils, we gave fad diets, et cetera, et cetera. And without exception, every single cook and bartender who worked at that event took the challenge in the exact way that we wanted to and used it as an opportunity to do something creative and interesting. Wiley, in fact, put the dish that he did there, the bone marrow, he put that on his New Year's menus.
Cool.
Brooks did his artichoke thing, I think, for a while. So it's a great thing for any cook to do, maybe not all the time, but, you know, on occasion, to take a challenge, take a set of constraints. And cooking something vegan is just at a set of constraints. And so the guys at Del Posto really like cooking this kind of thing. And it actually is on the menu all the time. They have a customer, they said, who comes in quite often. And whenever that customer comes in, they revamp the vegan menu for them. So it's not the same every time it comes in. This time, unfortunately, also macrobiotic, which, listen, I find it very difficult to not offend people, but not eating nightshades is crazy. No tomatoes. You're going to go vegan. Now you're all of a sudden, you're not going to have tomatoes, potatoes, or eggplants. I mean, please.
You can do without the eggplant, you said.
Well, you said, and I agreed.
Oh.
You said,
no,
and I agreed. I said, do you like baba ganoush? And you said, no.
Oh,
okay. I said, do you like anything with that kind of, no. She said, no. Doesn't like bacon barda. She likes eggplant parmesan, but mostly for the fry, the mozzarella, and the...
Exactly.
Anyway. One thing I'll have to say is that they should have shifted into liquor earlier.
Oh, yes. I emailed what's his name and told him that.
What's his name? It's a nice shout out.
Jeff Porter.
There you go. See? See how much nicer it is to use somebody's name instead of...
I was like, Mark.
Okay. So anyway, I'm here to report. So they said don't popularize it because even though they like cooking it, and this is a challenge to vegans out there. Anyone with there's wine glasses right here, Nastasha.
Oh, hello.
With dietary things out there, you have a reputation among chefs as being difficult human beings with which to work, and so their issue isn't that they don't like cooking the menu. Their issue is that in general, to generalize, the customers who order it can be problematic because they tend to not be people that are interested in food primarily. They're just there to get some, to have a meal, and they have these restrictions in which they're working, but the food isn't the primary focus, and cooks prefer to cook for people who like food. Fair?
Right.
And that's why they told us not to publicize it.
Yeah.
Am I saying that without getting anyone in too much trouble?
Yeah, you didn't use the exact language of what they called those people.
What? Now they're those people.
Yeah,
all right, what?
The vegan.
All right, so you say it then.
No, I'm not going to say what they
said. They did not insult vegan people.
Okay.
Anyways. My point is, it was very good. Unfortunately, it was also macrobiotic, which to me, I mean, someone please call in and tell me why macrobiotic stuff is not a bunch of hoo-ha. Anyone, call in. I know there's a lot of people out there who love macrobiotic.
They had two shots of green stuff.
I do not drink. Actually, we make a very good green drink at the bar.
Yeah.
Not macrobiotic, because you can't have distilled liquor. Yeah, those kind of like wheatgrassy, like, you know, one of the drinks, no offense to Jeff there, because I think they bought it and they did it on purpose just to shaft me, tasted like I had latched my mouth onto the exit chute of a lawnmower and was riding around the grass, with a lawnmower attached to my mouth. But the meal itself was very, very good. What do you think?
It was good for what it was.
So what the hell is that?
I would not go there and get it. Like, people who want that, get what they want, get a great meal. Right?
Well, I thought it was a really good meal. Like, Nastasha, first of all, is prejudiced in this sense. When she goes to an Italian restaurant, if she doesn't leave with her gut busting open, she's like, it's not Italian. Italian food's supposed to be hearty. It's supposed to be a hearty food. You know what I mean? And my point is, it's not necessarily
It's so sad to go to Del Posto and not eat a bunch of pasta. It's sad.
But so my point is that you have a preconceived notion of what Italian should be and of what Del Posto should be. So you can't divorce yourself from that notion and just look at the food as it was presented.
Sure.
What about, I thought the flavors were very, very well balanced. There was nothing that I thought was lacking. There's a lot of use of high umami and like protein-based things that weren't meat, like nutritional yeast, which was quite good. Obviously, a lot of mushrooms brought into it, a lot of reduced root vegetables, things like that. And I thought everything was delicious. I thought the textures were good. I thought it was well balanced. The one thing I didn't like were the raw snap peas on it, because even though everyone finds them delicious, except for me, because of the raw starch taste, I do not like pea shoots either, and I might be the only person on earth who does not like pea shoots, and because I don't like that raw. I don't like that raw taste. Part of the problem with me doing that raw diet last year
is
I don't like it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Anyways, so I thought they did an amazing job.
The wine was good. When we finally got wine, I liked it.
Oh, yeah. We had an orange wine that was, I guess, which we'll research more. I didn't research it a lot. And Nastasha at that point was dying for a drink. Speaking of that, speaking of dying for a drink, we have a wine here. You're going to have to translate this. What's Chieti?
Don't know.
I thought you spoke Italian. Now you forgot Italian too?
I don't know. We can look it up.
Oh, my God. Anyway, it's called Passetti, and it's Pecorino. Now, Pecorino, for all of you out there, obviously means goat. So is this wine, Jack, is this wine literally passed through a goat before it's put in a bottle?
I can't confirm or deny that.
Yeah? You can't,
I don't know.
I'm excited to try it.
It's from the Barter House, though. Remember those guys?
I was about to say, these are from our good friends at the Barter House. And I've said this before.
It's a province in Italy.
Really?
Oh, there you go.
Land of that province. Yeah, Chieti is a province.
For people who've been listening to the show forever, they're the same people who brought you Boozah.
Boozah! Yeah, so they're also bringing you wine passed through a goat. This is a white wine. What's the grape? Is there a grape called goat? What the heck is this?
and looking at it.
So here's the deal. So the Barter House, for those of you that they haven't sponsored our show in a while, mainly because Modernist Pantry has been sponsoring our show for a long time. But we like the folks at the Barter House, and what they are is a specialty importer that imports wines, kind of unusual and interesting wines. So they're not going to carry a lot of the wines that, you know, that we're familiar with. One of the good ways to see whether or not you should try a new wine in the store, and it's not just a Barter House, find an importer, someone who brings in wines you like. And in general, these people choose wines that they like that are interesting. So if you don't know the producer, you don't know the grape, you don't know the style, sometimes looking at the back and seeing who's bringing it in is a good indication of whether or not it'd be something interesting to try. And it's I think it's something that we don't do enough in wine stores. People don't think about the importers or the houses that choose wines or the curate, you know, the selections that they're going to bring over. But I think it's a good way to try a new wine. So we're going to, Nastasha and I, because it's so hot, we're going to have this white wine that's been passed through a goat. Passetti doesn't mean pass. Passato means pass, yeah. Right? So yeah, what does Passetti mean?
This is their last name.
Oh, that's the name of the people?
It's a husband and wife team, Franco and Mima.
Mima Passetti? So hand me my glass so we can try this stuff. And we should get to some actual cooking issues here in a minute. Otherwise, this is going to be a show just based on nonsense and drivel. Let's try it. No offense to nonsense and drivel. Wait, what do you think, Stas?
It's really sweet, huh?
It's not actually sweet. It's just not like hyper dry and crisp.
Mm-mm. It's fine. Fine. What do you think, Dave?
And what would you pair it with, Stas?
I would pair it with pecorino cheese.
You're such a loser. You know what? Whatever. That brings me to another thing. Before we get into real stuff, you know, there's been a lot of play recently on our show and nowhere else on the taste pairing hypothesis, and this hypothesis where things that have similar molecules, not necessarily similar. Nastasha apparently believes if you name something after a goat, it should go well with goat cheese.
It's stuck in my head. But yeah, I think it would go well, don't you?
I think almost everything goes well with a pecorino. I like pecorino. I don't know. Like, you know, it's one of those things that has enough acidity to it that it could go well with a spicy or like an Asian thing. It's not going to get totally cut down. It's not, the structure of it isn't like a red that's going to get obliterated. So I could see it with that.
Asian thing.
What the hell is that? What the hell is that under your breath Asian thing?
She just said it would go like well a spicy Asian thing.
Okay. I'm thinking about it because we were at Pak Pak, New York, Pak Pak Brooklyn. Yeah. So now we've become a review show where we're reviewing restaurants that we've been to over the past
week.
But
we only went to two in one day. It's like we don't do anything together. We don't go out to restaurants. We
never... Yeah, thank God. Yeah. Thank God. But so my wife and I were at the table next to Nastasha, Mark Ladner from Del Posto, Brooks, and her friend from Juilliard, Patrick Posey. this is Andy Ricker's, not Richter, the comedian, Andy Ricker, the famous formerly Portland, now Portland and New York-based chef who does Thai kind of in a different way than I've ever had it in New York. And because I've never been to Thailand, so I can't call it authentic, but extremely delicious, extremely great food. And I'd only ever had Pak Pak Wing, which is his takeout joint in the Lower East Side, and his food at events. So it's the first time I got to go to basically a full-scale restaurant of his. And I was, frankly, blown away. I thought it was great. And what do you think, Stas?
Yeah, it was amazing. And I hate Thai food.
Well, okay, when Nastasha says she hates Thai food, those of you that have ever listened to this show knows that they know that Nastasha's crazy, basically. here's what she doesn't like about... Here's when she says she doesn't like Thai food, here's what she means. I don't like lemongrass, and I don't like coconut milk,
and
right?
Peanut sauce, yeah.
And peanuts. I don't know... It was, so what?
So there wasn't a lot of that in this food at all.
Right. Anyway, but... That's not my point. My point is that Nastasha's crazy, and that this restaurant was great. For instance, the thing that, the thing that blew me away is that... He served an extremely spicy beef dish. I forget the name of it. Kind of ground meat. And next to it was just a plate of herbs. Hoibs. And these herbs, they look like, you know, a plate of herbs. And I started to taste them, and they were unlike any herbs you'd ever tasted. Like, when he came over, I basically had the waiter call him over because, and Mark, too, was like, look. If you're in the business that I'm in or the market, no one's supposed to be able to, in New York City, hand you a plate of herbs and have the first four things you taste off of it be unlike anything that you've ever had and completely foreign to you such that you have no idea what the hell's going on. That just doesn't happen. Do you know what I mean? Like one or two new ingredients, whatever, or new ingredient, but something that's just totally foreign to you like that is crazy, right? Didn't you agree with that, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
And like this one had the kind of tartness of a sorrel, but like a completely different taste. I want to use that in a drink. Andy gets it, some guy in Florida, who smuggled seeds from Thailand to Florida and is growing these kind of insane Thai herbs in Florida and then shipping them up to Andy. And he gets them on consignment from this guy. I'm going to try to get some for the bar. For Booker and Dax, but it's just crazy stuff, good stuff. I recommend going. Okay, enough with the restaurant reviews. Else, right? Oh, one more piece of news from Booker and Dax land, and then I guess we should go
to lab.
Yeah, Booker and Dax. Well, it won't be ready for about a month, but we now have Booker and Dax, the company, not the bar, has its own space in the Lower East Side. So look out for us coming in doing some cool stuff in the Lower East Side. Correct?
Yeah.
It's a small space.
Doesn't matter. It's a storefront, which is awesome.
It's our own space. So those of you can stop by, like, wave vegetables at Nastasha in the window, and she can make her face for you in about a month. And with that, call your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues. And welcome back to Cooking Issues. By the way, today's show is going to be brought to you by The Barter House.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Okay. Jack just told me.
Oh, I didn't hear.
Yeah, you wouldn't pay attention. Nastasha's like, I don't know, I was playing Tetris. Anyway, before I go on to some real issues, I want to talk about this book, Taste Buds and Molecules, about the flavor pairing hypothesis. So I've been basically saying for a while that I think that this flavor pairing hypothesis is bunk, whereby, you know, you take, foods that share specific flavor compounds, and therefore you can decide that they actually go well together. And it's a technique that's gotten a lot of play recently. And so I kind of thought I'd go buy, and I bought it, a book called Taste Buds and Molecules, written by François Chatier. And I think that's how he pronounces his name. I don't know. He's Quebecois, but he's done a lot of work in France, and he is like a true master sommelier. Like, nobody argues, the man knows his wine. And sometime in the early to mid 2000s, he started working on the idea of flavor pairing, looking up what components were in a wine, the aromatics of wine. And a lot of that stuff is readily actually available because a lot of studies have been done on it due to wine quality issues. And so a lot of food studies have been done on it. And also when those same molecules appear in foods, and has built a structure of tastings and basically food pairings based on what he calls his research into those things. And the result is this book, Taste Buds and Molecules, which also has like a lot of crazy kind of graphical elements. And so I bought it thinking that I was going to hate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are many things about it that I disagree with, but I have to say that he clearly understands, from everything I've read about him, I've never had dinner with him or anything, but has a very good palate, right? So this isn't, in other words, it's not something where someone is just saying, hey, look it, here's a bunch of stuff that I saw on a piece of paper, and therefore they're going to go well together, even though I haven't developed a palate. He's coming at it from the direction that I think is a good one, namely, he spent years and years developing his palate, right? His nose, his palate, his senses. And then after those years, then used these kind of pieces of research as a further tool to get inspiration in areas he hadn't already looked. Basically, something to help the light bulb or the chime in his head say, yes, these two things would go well together, and to give him kind of the confidence to put two things together that wouldn't ordinarily be put together. And so, to that extent, you know, yes, I think it could be used as a valid thing, and I actually ended up liking liking what he was saying more than I thought I would. But on the flip side, I mean, and I think this is part of the kind of like the, you know, because the book was published in French first, that kind of writing, it's a little more kind of florid, and it kind of takes things a lot further than I would like, and kind of makes much more sweeping comments about you know, what he's doing and the concepts behind it than I would like. And so, you know, when I'm working on the cocktail book, I got to guard against that too, not making these kind of sweeping statements. My problem is when any of these things become sort of dogmatic or almost become a religion, the way, you know what I mean, the way that people kind of treat the new concepts. But interesting book. So there's that. That's my last word on the flavor pairing hypothesis for today. Now, on to some questions we come in. Hello from Osaka, Japan. We're going to Japan soon. Nastasha and I are going to Tokyo to work in the Park Hyatt. We're going to be working there for 4 days, right? Mm-hmm. Plus a fifth press day.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to get the, like, I want the most butt-kicking Japanese stuff. I don't want any stuff that I can get here in the States. I mean, I do. I want to see, like, how much better all the stuff that they say is better there. I want to get all that when I'm there, but I want some stuff that you cannot get here. I mean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You with me on this?
They're taking us to the market.
Tsukiji and the other one.
No, there's a big fruit market next to it.
So. I'm going to go bonkers. Yeah. And they're with their credit card?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm a dangerous person with someone else's credit card.
That's as soon as you arrive. You're going straight there.
So I better sleep. I can't sleep on planes. I'll have to drink like 8 loads of espresso, just make like an hour trip to the bathroom, and then we'll go off into it, right?
Yes.
Okay. Hello from Osaka, Japan. I have 2 questions. I'm interested in buying a refractometer to use in the field as well as in the kitchen. Some things I would like to be able to do are measure the salinity of a brine to know when it has reached equilibrium, measure the sugar content of produce in the field to know when to harvest, measure the sugar quantity of produce to determine which provider has the best product. Can one refractometer be used to measure salinity as well as Brix? Do you have any recommendation for refractometers? Are electronic Brix meters better than optical refractometers? Okay. Here's the thing. I've used both electric ones. We have one manufactured by the Hanna Corporation, as well as manual ones. The for the field, I mean, the thing is, you don't want to be caught out in the field with one and have it break. I mean, the optical ones are fairly bulletproof. I mean, Nastasha did break one of mine. She like shattered the I don't know how the heck she did it. She broke it. No one else has ever broken it. She broke the little flip down screen that goes on. The handheld ones, the ones that are not electronic, are a lot cheaper. They're like $32 to get the ones on eBay. They work fine. You need light, you know what I mean? And you need to be able to see through the product somewhat to be able to do it, you know, to use them properly. Those ones, I've never seen one that'll do both salinity and Brix. However, well, you know, you can get just a Brix one, and which measures sugar content, and get one that is for salinity, and they're fairly small, and they're fairly cheap. So you can get 2 of them, right, for much less than the cost of one good electronic one. I really like the electronic one for just speed of use and not having, especially in the bar, to worry about light. You do have to, with the electronic ones, hold your hand sometimes over the measurement device so that you don't get errant light problems. If there's too much ambient light, you can't work with it. The electronic ones are better for just crushing up some juice, even if it has particles, and throwing on, because they're not as thrown off by that and they're easier to read. You can read something in an electronic one. That there's a really cute kid looking in through our window, by the way. She's pressing her nose against it and we're waving to the window. There's a she's wearing some sort of purple flowery thing. Yeah, very cute. Anyway, so the electronic ones are better at measuring things that you couldn't necessarily, because in a handheld one, you have to be able to flap the glass down, the plastic piece that goes over the reading prism. You have to be able to flap it down and get good contact before you can get a good reading. And you don't need to do that with the handheld electronic ones. I do think that the handheld electronic ones might break a little easier. The Hanna ones that I have are only calibrated for Brix, right? You could, and mine is, what I like about mine is that, especially if you're going to be using something for a long time in a lot of different fields, and you might be measuring juice one day or fruit one day and syrups the next, is that mine, my electronic one, goes from 0 Brix to 85% Brix, which is really nice. And there are handheld optical ones that have a very wide range, but the problem is that those wide range ones, it's hard to get a very accurate reading because the scale is the same length no matter what you do, and so then you have the issue of not being able to discern fine differences in bricks. Now, there are also triple scale manual refractometers. I've never used one, and those apparently you can get the accuracy you want in several different scale ranges, but they tend to be more expensive. So instead of like $32, you're talking about $100, $150, and you can get a decent electronic one on eBay for not eBay on Amazon or whatnot for, you know, around that price. What do we pay?
$260
for a 0 to 85. Now, there is a company, I don't have theirs unfortunately, called I believe Spare is the company, but you can look it up, that has different ranges in the same refractometer, and they will actually program three custom ranges into your refractometer for you, so you could get a 0 to 85 bricks refractometer and at the same time get a salinity meter. And all it's basically doing is changing the calibration within the unit so that you can measure using the same instrument. Another thing you could do is use your bricks refractometer and then carefully make things of the proper salinity, right? Measure what the bricks is on it, and then you can hit that number every time, even though you're using a brick scale. So you can correct bricks to salinity. It's hard sometimes to find the published papers for that on the internet, but you can also do that. The last thing I would caution about refractometers in general is that you're going to have a lot of people make mistakes on refractometers, and they think that you can measure bricks and other things in mixed medium. Remember, all that the refractometer is measuring is what the difference in refraction is as light is passed through a liquid. So what happens is different liquids have different refractive indexes. They bend light a different amount. And a refractometer is measuring typically how much your liquid bends light relative to water. And so they can only, what Brix is measuring is dissolved sugar, but anything that changes, any solute, anything that's dissolved in it is going to change it. So if you have alcohol, which changes the angle of refraction, right? If all you have is alcohol, then you can use a refractometer to measure how much alcohol is in the water. If all you have is alcohol and water. If all you have is sugar in water, then you can measure how much sugar there is in the water using a refractometer. If all you have is salt in water, same. If you have salt and sugar, you cannot. Because there's no way to figure out what each component is doing to the refractive index independently unless you can measure one of the variables. Same thing with ethanol and sugar, which is why you can't use a refractometer to measure something like Cointreau because it's got both sugar and alcohol in it. So there are limitations to what a refractometer can do for you because it's only measuring one quantity, how much light is bent as it travels through your medium. So, I hope that helps. But if I could go back, because the Spare one's only like an extra $50, but it wasn't on Amazon, I would get the multi-range electronic bricks unit that does 0 to 85. They have a wide-scale one. I think it's Spare, but, whatever. S-P-E-R, I think. I'm not sure. I would get there one that does the full range from 0 to 85. That's going to do 99% of any of the sugar work you want. And they will also do a custom scale. So if you wanted to do, I don't know what you're doing for a living, but let's say you're a distiller or something, and you also need to measure, or a wine fermenter, and you also need to measure glycol. You could have a glycol scale in there so that you can make your glycol solutions, which you would use for when you're using like chilling. If you have a chiller and you need to do glycol, you could put a glycol scale in and a salinity scale. So you could choose any three scales. If it was me, I would have bricks, salinity, and ethanol percentage for distilled spirits. I would have those three on it, and then you'd have one refractometer and you'd be good forever. But you might want to back it up with a manual one. The manual one, most people get a 0 to 32 bricks if you're doing fruit, and a much higher refractometer, a much higher bricks level if you're doing anything like sugars or syrups. Because remember, simple syrup, 1-to-1 simple syrup is running about 50 bricks, right? So you can't measure it on a standard 0 to 32 bricks refractometer. Bricks is basically just percentage of the solution that is sucrose, right? And if you're doing 2-to-1 simple syrup, you're up at 66 bricks. And so it can get, 0 to 32 is of limited use in a bar, right? Right, mm-hmm. Saz? Yeah, that's why you bought the 0-85 for us.
Yes.
And we're quite happy with it, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Another piece of equipment we have at the bar we're very happy with now is we bought best $65. That's not true. What the fuck? I'm just lying. It's a good $65. Not the best $65 I've ever spent. the best $65 I ever spent was on my wife's wedding ring. Boom! Kidding. But
he's not lying.
Yeah, I'm a cheap bastard. yeah, no, it was a good $65. I bought a 0 to 5 milliliter basically micropipette, and it's just super accurate. So we use it to dose all of our wine finding agents, kiesel salt and chitosan. And also, when we're making small batches of things to correct things for salinity and whatnot, we can add small amounts that we can then reproduce when we scale it up. So I really like the micropipette. And we stole that idea from our friend Tony Conigliaro, not the famous dead baseball player from. You know the story of Tony Conigliaro?
No.
Very famous. Tony C, they call him, because also Americans. In America, it's Conigliaro, by the way. So Tony, the baseball player, was Tony Conigliaro, not Tony Conigliaro, the bartender, right? But he was slated to be one of the best baseball players of all time, was in fact very good, played for the Bo Sox, and he crowded the plate all the time and got hit in the head with a beaner. And I think it put him in a coma. He's in the hospital for a long time. Never the same. Never the same. By the way, what Nastasha is actually doing, the work she's doing, is looking up pictures of the chauffeur from Downton Abbey on... I looked over to see what kind of thing she's looking up about the event I'm doing in Germany that we're going to talk about after the next break. And she's looking up the chauffeur, kind of like the least sympathetic character on Downton Abbey. Because... Not the least sympathetic, but
no,
I mean...
No. It's not...
No, 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 what?
It's what the stars look like out of costume. That's
true. But you've already seen that.
I know, but I was...
Crazy. This is what I deal with people on a daily basis. All right. The second question from Osaka, from John, is, are there antioxidants that are fat-soluble as well as temperature-stable up to temperatures around 180 degrees Celsius? Failing that, what is the best practice when storing fats to keep them in their best condition? Two applications I'm interested in are reusing very expensive tempura oil and keeping schmaltz without oxidizing. Any thoughts? Schmaltz! I love schmaltz. Chicken fat is delicious. I've never been to one of the old school restaurants in New York that has schmaltz on the table, like one of the old kosher restaurants, because you can't have butter on the table, because you can't serve butter in a steakhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You can have schmaltz. I freaking love chicken fat. So what can you do? Well, I forgot that this question had been asked when I saw it last night, so I didn't look up the specific things that are added. But typically, if you buy commercial fry oil, they have an antioxidant in them. Some sort of vitamin E tocopherol based thing that's fat soluble that prevents oxidation in the oil, and that is very helpful and stable up to frying temperatures. I'll try to look it up during the break, or Nastasha can try to look it up now instead of looking up Downton Abbey's before and after pictures. But the and that's why I say commercial fry oil is much, much better than any of the stuff that we buy in the supermarket, because it lasts just a boatload longer and tastes a lot cleaner. They also, in commercial fry oils, do something that you can't do in a home oil, which is they specifically, and tempura oil might be like this, they specifically tailor the fatty acid mix in it to have only those fatty acids that are fairly temperature stable and oxidation resistant. That said, obviously, the things that cause oil to break down most are if you get salt in the oil, which is sometimes unavoidable, allowing burnt particles to stay in the bottom of the oil while you're cooking if you don't have a commercial fryer with a cold zone at the bottom, which tempura doesn't work that way, by the way, which is crazy, but whatever. So those are the main things. You also, it's best to use, and this again goes against the way I've seen most tempura done, but you really want a very low surface area to volume ratio on the oil, because then you have less air contact. You want as little foaming as possible, so not a lot of a lot of high water stuff dripping in. Anything that basically is going to promote a large amount of oxygen getting into the oil. Also, clearly, you don't want any reactive metals like iron touching the stuff, because that's gonna mess with you. And you want to, as soon as it cools down enough, filter it. And you could. You could vacuum pack it, or put it in bottles and then suck the air out of it to prevent any sort of oxidation from taking place. But those are the kinds of things that I would do. The worst thing, though, I see breakdown on oil, especially when it's done in a home fryer, is temperature cycling. And there's just very little you can do to prevent temperature cycling, except for the commercial fryers are really what's going to stop you from doing a lot of temperature cycling. Other than that, you could get an induction unit that keeps the oil at a relatively even temperature that has, like, basically a temperature controller in it that's, you know, keeping the oil tolerances fairly tight, and then not overloading the oil so that you don't have to get the you don't have to have as much of a temperature drop, so you don't need as high of a thermal input to do the instant recovery, and that's going to cause you to have less thermal cycling on your oil, and that's going to increase the lifetime significantly. In a home frying situation, it's crap floating to the bottom, burning and destroying the oil, salt, but most importantly, temperature cycling that is really killing your oil at a ferocious rate. And those are the things that I would do. I don't know about, are you looking up the vitamin E, the tocopherol-based stuff? Or are we still on Downton Abbey?
No, no, I was doing the Germany stuff.
All right, well, okay. So why don't we do this? We'll take a commercial break, and we'll see whether Nastasha can find that stuff on the internet. It's cooking issues. Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Am I back?
Yeah.
All right. So it turns out that I wasn't able to look it up over the commercial break, but we'll try to find some specific thing that you can go buy in a store to drop into your oil to add as an antioxidant. So, Nastasha, what's this event that I'm doing in El Germany next week?
It's called Academia del Ron, and it's a Havana Club event. And you will be there from – you arrive Monday morning – and you leave Thursday.
Well, I don't know that people need to know my schedule. What am I talking about there?
We're talking about yeast in alcohol.
Yeah. So here's the deal. So they asked me to do this event on rum, and I said fine. But they like I feel like I spend a lot of time trying to become like well versed in several things. But the effect of yeast on rum. Like, I can think of at least five other people that I know personally who know more about this than I do, right?
Yeah.
But yet, that's what they wanted me to talk about. See, people make the mistake of, and I'm not saying anything against it, but people make the mistake of thinking that I'm a scientist. I'm not. I'm like a gearhead cook that can read science papers, right? So, like, I don't feel like I'm the guy to sit there and talk to you about, like, any sort of actual research that I've done or anything, because it's just not the case. So over the past week and a half, I read, I don't know, several hundred pages on the effects of yeast on different, on fermentation products. And I've learned a boatload about it, but I still am not an expert in the field on this. So what I had to do was I just basically took a bunch of molasses. I couldn't get the molasses I like, which is Crosby's molasses, which is a...
Never got back to me.
Those bastards.
That email that you were like.
They never got back? Mm. Crosby's molasses, for any of you who have ever been in Northeast New England or Maine, Crosby's molasses is the one molasses that I've had that you're like, my God, is that delicious molasses. Like, I would pour that. You know how, like, you ever listen to Louis Jordan? You ever listen to Louis Jordan?
Mm-mm.
Louis Jordan, you know the song Is You Ain't My Baby or Caledonia or Beware, any of those? That's Louis Jordan. Like, big in the 40s, you know, kind of cocktail, kind of like, you know. Like, you know, whatever. Like, anyway. Like, musician. You know, musician. Anyway. Beans and Cornbread. You know that song?
Yes.
Beans and Cornbread. You know that? Anyway, Louis Jordan. So, Louis Jordan. What the hell was I talking about Louis Jordan for? What were we talking about?
Fermentation.
Yeah, but how the hell did I get on Louis Jordan?
Molasses.
So he's like, in the Beans and Cornbread song, he goes together like, hotcakes and molasses. And you're like, hotcakes and molasses? That's who gross. The hell would put molasses on pancakes, and then once you've had Crosby's molasses, you realize why. But those dumb bastards from Crosby's, they're up in Canada. And by the way, I love you Canadians, but you're a lazy group of people. Just kidding. Just kidding.
He's not.
just kidding. Anyway, but they won't distribute outside of New England. We had to mail her, so I couldn't.
So we wrote them, you wrote them a nice email from me in response to how great their molasses
is. Yeah, sell it down here.
Sell it down here. No response back.
Crosby's molasses is so delicious. Like, when you next time you're in Maine or wherever over there, up there New England way, get some Crosby's molasses and tell me you don't think that's the most delicious molasses that you've ever had. I mean, I don't know, maybe in the Caribbean, they have some delicious molasses. I don't know. But as far as in the continental U.S., it's the most delicious molasses I've ever had. Anyway, so we didn't use that. We used some sort of, like, molasses. And we're distilling our own. I fermented using two separate yeasts. Now, when you're actually doing rum and you're using wild yeast fermentation, it's not just Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the normal beer, you know, brewer's yeast, of which there's a bazillion strains, each of which have different produce different flavors. But there's like I forget the names of them, like schizo Saccharomyces cerevisiae. There's a whole bunch of different yeast strains, like five or six actual genus species, and then a zillion strains, all of which produce different flavors. It turns out most of the flavoral difference in a fermentation, a lot of the flavoral difference is due to the yeast, right? So think about it this way, Nastasha. If you've ever had wine grapes?
Yeah, like to eat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wine grapes don't taste like wine. Right. It's very difficult to, like, if you taste like a Pinot Noir grapes, you're not like, oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That all of the, like, the most of the flavors that are in there in Pinot Noir are there as precursors, right, that you can't taste. Then the fermentation and the different yeasts that are used bring out the real character. So a lot of the flavor is due to the yeast. It's just I don't happen to be an expert in that. But that's what I'm going to be talking about.
And then, I think people ask you to talk about these things because you're able to understand it and explain it in an interesting and exciting way.
Well, that's very charitable. That's your
special thing for the week.
Yeah. So that's the one nice thing Nastasha's going to say to me all week. So anyway, so over the course of the week, we're going to have to go out and illegally distill the molasses fermentation. By the way, fermented molasses tastes horrible. This blackstrap molasses stuff tasted horrible. Tasted like iron. I was told by our friend Chris, who's opening a new beer bar in New York called Proletariat. Proletariat. Well, Nastasha gave the Proletariat face. She hates the vegans and the people.
Tell them about your MTV Belvedere drink. Did you guys talk more about that yesterday?
No. Do you tell me about it?
The Red Bull that you're going to make?
Oh, Nastasha signed us up to do a Jersey Shore. For those of you that haven't been outside, there's a show called Jersey Shore, which I actually haven't seen, but I saw the thing on YouTube where the guy punched that lady out.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah, what? That's Snooki, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, I haven't seen the show. Have you seen the show?
Small.
You
bits.
Have. I actually watched an episode. This is serious. Like, last week, I watched an episode for the first time. It's good. It's
really?
A funny show.
Yeah?
It's a funny show.
I'm pro. Well, one of our favorite lawyers is from the Jersey Shore.
Yes.
Vadim.
Good guy.
Yeah, good guy. Anyway, Nastasha signed us up to do an MTV party with Evan Freeman. And it's going to be a Jersey Shore party. And so Nastasha wants us to do a high-end vodka Red Bull.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're working on it. But I don't know what Red Bull... I don't really know much about Red Bull.
No, we need a...
We need to look it up?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take that stuff up. Anyway. By the way, we got some shout-out from John, who asked the two questions on Osaka. He says, loves the show. Thank you. With so much, and this is in general about the world. Here we go. With so much knowledge, this is John talking. With so much knowledge being spread around, I don't think there's ever been a more exciting time to be a cook. In Japan, it was commonly accepted that the price you pay to become a cook is your youth. That's kind of nicely said.
Mm-hmm.
In 5 years, I've been able to learn what would normally take 10, and on top of that, I know the why behind the how, which seems to be a very uncommon thing in Japan. Whoa, boom. We're going to have some talks about that when we're in Japan, huh? Seemed to be very uncommon in Japan. So here is a thank you for you guys and everyone else sharing what they know. And it's true. We would not have what's going on today without the increase in kind of sharing of information that's been made possible by, you know, it is the internet. Like, obviously it's the internet. But I think it's other things. I think that, I've had some conversations with some European chefs, especially in America, but also among Spanish, just this extreme desire to share what people know and to be generous with ideas that it is in the cook community. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You agree?
Yeah.
But for instance, Tim Rauer, the Michelin star chef in the Germany, which where I'll be next. Hey, he's in Berlin. Maybe I should see him when I'm in Berlin. Anyway, he said in Germany the chefs don't hang out and give each other ideas. Weird, huh?
It's too bad.
Too bad. Too bad. Too bad. Okay. Hey, Dave, Nastasha, and Jack. Jack, you got the shout-out on this one. This is, you don't know who it's from, Nastasha. You got to look this up. Oh, from Tony Harrion from Mixing Bar in Brazil. I read a post on Alcademics, our good friend Camper English, the blogger. I read this post on Alcademics about the production of Cointreau, because he visited the Cointreau distillery, that says, when they add water to reduce Cointreau to proof, the essential oils in the peel, because it's Cointreau's orange peel distillation along with neutral grain spirit, cause the liquor to louche, to get cloudy, like when you add water to absinthe. They centrifuge the Cointreau to make it clear again, which I did not know. The same happens, and this is now it's Tony talking. The same happens when we rotovap citrus peels and other spices and dilute it to proof. Other than the centrifuge, what can be done to separate the compounds that fall out of solution when you dilute liquids with high concentrations of essential oils? Can you think of any other way to stabilize or avoid the precipitation or louche without the centrifuge? And then how good does your centrifuge need to be to achieve louche separation in G's or RPM? Lastly, to make liquors in this fashion, do you recommend adding water to reduce the proof and then adding the sugar, or use a weak sugar syrup or both at once, with or without the centrifuge at the step? Love the show. Keep up the great work. Cheers, Tony Harrion from Mixing Bar in Brazil, which when I go to Brazil, we got to find someone who will pay to get us to Brazil. And then after we do that, we will visit them. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. One, by the way, this is anyone who wants to get the Cooking Issues crew down to Brazil. Keep this in mind. I don't know what it cost for a plane ticket down there, but polyscience circulators are twice the cost in Brazil as they are here. So what we can do, if you want a circulator, right, if you can find some company to pay for us, we can buy the circulators here, bring them down as personal equipment for the events, and then do a swap down there. Just saying.
And you might need help carrying them, so, you know, I'm here.
Yeah, just saying. Yeah. Just saying. Just an idea for all you people in Brazil. If you're trying to get around the tax problem of getting a circulator into the country, and you know a company that wants to ship a bunch of tech knuckleheads down there to talk to
it's
them.
About $1,000 a person to get down there, which...
That's about to see you break even.
Yeah.
You break even.
You're fast.
Yes. Yeah. Well, with that, when it comes to getting Nastasha a trip to Brazil, blinding speed. Blinding. Ask her about tocopherol. What? What's that? Crickets are in the background. Jesus. All right. Here's my feeling, Tony. I have this happen a lot with, we do a distillate, because Thai basil is like one of my favorite beverage flavors. So we do one that's Thai basil, orange, cucumber, and a little bit of cilantro. And that thing louches out and goes white like very quickly. I think it's not so much the orange peel in that, because we don't add a lot. I think it's probably the anethole, which is the same thing that's causing louching in a pastis, because there's a good bit of that in Thai basil. You know, that licorice flavor.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, in that Taste Buds and Molecules book, like one of the interesting things is that there's I think it's estragol is a compound that shared that's in fennel. Actually, one of those compounds is in apple to a certain amount. Maybe this is the thing that the book actually gave me some interesting concepts. Harold McGee and I years ago when we went to Geneva. Harold McGee's gonna be in town later this week. Harold McGee, we're gonna eat surströmming with Nils. Got to set that up on my wife's birthday though. It might be problematic. So we had some apples that grew on the tree that had a huge fennel note to them, and then the fennel dissipated very quickly, but probably due to that volatile molecule. Anyway, so like that book actually brought up some interesting stuff in my head, brought back some taste memories I had. So anyway, kudos to that, whatever. When you dilute them to proof, they are going to louche out. Even if I've had ones that I've done that to and then let sit for several months, and they basically separate over time as well. My feeling is, I don't know. Here's the thing. Whenever I've tasted these things straight out of the centrifuge, straight out of the rotovap, I love the flavor of them fresh so much that I wouldn't want to change them. And I don't mind the louching. I don't mind the pastis effect. I kind of like it. It's kind of a signature of that you made this product, and that it has so much like of these essential oils in it that they can't be held in solution when the proof goes up. Instead of diluting to proof, I almost always keep my, unless I'm going to serve it straight like an akavit, I almost always, and that I've had akvavits that go white on me because we get so much essential oil in them from the RotoVap. I almost always keep them at RotoVap proof, which for us is between $1 and $1.20, so about 60%, and we keep it there until we're about to use it, and then let it loosh out, and it's more stable on the flavor. If you don't want to do that, I don't think it would take that many G's, but I think it would take quite a long time because the particles when you're looshing are very, very small. and so you have to wait for them to kind of coalesce, aggregate, and become larger before you can get them to settle out. So I think probably centrifuging and time are needed. Another hard part about throwing in the centrifuge is that you remember these are oils and they float to the top. And so you that's my guess, it would float to the top. And so when you spin them, you'd be in this position of siphoning them off the top or getting the stuff out of the bottom, which may or may not be a difficulty because they're not going to go solid if you freeze it the same way that I can do with nut oils or coconut oil. So those are my thoughts on that. Okay, last question in, because apparently we have to wrap it up because, you know, Jack's got other things to do. Other shows. Okay. Five fifth questions apparently today. Although, why do you number them? Because I don't ever do them in order anyway. Like, why put numbers on them?
What do you want instead?
I don't know. Anyway, this does, people don't care. I don't know why I asked. Okay, Andrew writes in and says, two things. What is your recipe for pressure cooked mustard caviar? I cannot seem to find one online by you yourself. Thanks, Andrew. Here's my recipe. Pressure cooked mustard seeds are awesome. They pop like caviar. They're delicious. Even Nastasha likes them. She hates everything I cook. It's not true. I'm just messing with her because I can. Okay. First thing with a mustard seed, I use the yellow mustard seeds. I blanch them quickly in a couple of two times or three times in boiling water for a couple seconds apiece to get rid. It does get rid of some of the pungency, so much so that you can almost get away with not pressure cooking, but it's not the same thing. We've done the test, right? But it gets rid of some of the dirty, musty taste that I don't really like in a mustard seed. We blanch horseradish as well beforehand to get rid of some of that earthy taste. Then you pressure cook them afterwards in straight vinegar. I use distilled vinegar. I pressure cook them for between 15 and 20 minutes at second ring in excess vinegar. They're going to soak up a lot of vinegar, so you don't want to go light on the vinegar. Then you drain them, and while they're hot, you stir in, I use white, you can use whatever you want, but I use white granulated sugar to taste. The sugar will dissolve in with the vinegar that's still on the outside of the mustard seed. Don't want to add the vinegar beforehand. It's going to become a goopy mess. Add the vinegar after it's cooked and drain while it's still warm, hot, but preferably, and just keep tasting it. Then you pack it in its residual juice. You can, if you save a little bit of vinegar, you can add a little bit in a quart container, and it lasts for a long time. So that's that recipe. And we have one other suggestion in before I leave, because I'd be remiss. We had a question last week regarding thermocouple probes, and our good listener, Elliot Papineau, called in a response and said, I use a dual probe alarm meter from www.thermoworks.com, and it's a cool dual probe thermocouple thermometer, and they have some cool looking probes. The probes aren't cheap, but the thermometer is, so there you have it. Elliot likes it. Tell us whether you like it too. See you next week, hopefully from Germany. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
You got my head all twisted. Can't get it straight.